Welcome to the Abbots for Today podcast. Today, we're so excited to be joined by former Premier Bill Vanderzem. He's here to talk about passenger rail in the Fraser Valley on the old interurban community rail line. We're also going to dig into how he got started in politics and a whole lot more. Join us, will you? Welcome, everybody, to the Abbots for Today podcast. I am joined by a very special guest today, former Premier of the province of British Columbia, Bill Vanderzem. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been lucky enough to visit Mr. Vanderzem out at his lovely spread in under the blue sky today. And we got in our car to drive out here from Abbotsford. It was a fair bit of a drive. A lovely drive, but we had the luxury of taking our time. And I think it won't come as a surprise to people that we want to talk to you today about the interurban rail line and the future of passenger rail through the entire Fraser Valley. But before we get stuck into that, I'd like to give our listeners the opportunity to find out a little bit more about you. I just mentioned that you're the former premier of the province, but you bring a lot more expertise to this issue than just that position. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your time in government and your time focusing on issues like transit in the province?
I started in local politics in the mid-60s, and I was first elected a councillor in Surrey. After I served as councillor for 4 years, I decided I wanted to be the mayor. We had our ambitions, we had our plans, we had our dreams, so that was the goal. So I ran for mayor and I was elected in 1969-70. And I was mayor for 5 years when Bill Bennett, then premier of the province, convinced me that I should be involved politically at the provincial level. So I was elected at the provincial level, and Bill Bennett first appointed me in the most troublesome ministry he had, which was social services. I had no problems taking on any portion or any position, and social services I thought was something that needed a lot of attention, so it was a challenge. When I was elected, I was obviously introduced after the announcement and the swearing in, and the media then asked me the first question, Mr. Vanderzem, Mr. Minister, you have a reputation in Surrey. Whenever there was a problem with respect to too much welfare because people were traveling from all over the country to visit in Surrey, the first thing they did back in those days, that was quite prevalent, was make application for welfare at the local office because it was a municipal responsibility at the time. And you wouldn't issue welfare to people under 40 or 45, I think it was, years of age, if there was work to be done and they were capable of doing it. So the order of the time was, if there's strawberries to be picked or potatoes to be bugged, it was to be dug. It was all a hand operation back in those days anyway. They would get the benefit, get the help, but first do a job, go do a day's work. So while there was potatoes to be dug or strawberries to be picked, there was no welfare issued. So the question was, with that reputation in Surrey, what can people expect from you as Minister of Social Services at the provincial level? And my response immediately was, well, no problem. If they're handicapped or in need, truly in need, I'm there to help. And the handicapped probably need a lot more help than what they've been getting, and I'll look into that first thing. And if they're elderly, we shouldn't question what the needs within reason. We help them all we can. However, if they're capable, if they're younger, or if they're under 50 years of age, and they can work, and they refuse to take the work, they better pick up a shovel now, or I'll give them a shovel. So the shovel quote became almost international. It was told everywhere. And I had to wear the shovel quote up until even today. People remind me of it. And so I served at that level for a time. Things went well. We cut back on the welfare budget enormously. Keep in mind, we were the first, we were first elected, I was, as a Social Credit Party member. And we followed immediately upon the NDP. And the NDP at the time certainly had been rather generous, if not perhaps too easy at giving things out. So I was in charge of the budget, and I had no difficulty cutting back on the expenses. I did so well, as a matter of fact, that the premier came back to me shortly after that, well, shortly, a couple of years later, when things were going well within social services, and said, would you take on municipal affairs and transit? Those are two things that are perhaps in need of some tougher controls. So I took on municipal affairs, which I was familiar with, having served as a mayor and councillor. And I was new to transit, but I was certainly learning very quickly. And I was made the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Transit. And one of the first things that landed on my plate was a request from the regional district, particularly Vancouver. The mayor at the time was Mike Harcourt. The request came to us to approve a transit system for Vancouver that they had basically in mind or planned and wanted to go ahead with. Well, I had no problem with getting transit to Vancouver. I knew the need of it. But they came back with an on-ground rail system for Vancouver. And I said, what are you going to do when you cross Kingsway 14 times? It's going to be a problem. There's a lot of traffic there now, but it'll be worse over time. You've got all these tracks going to cross the Kingsway and other streets. How long will the system last before you look to replace it with something else? Well, they didn't have the answers. We went through all of that. And I was familiar with something I had seen in Seattle. They had an elevated train in Seattle that was there for a long time, a monorail system. And I wanted to look into that a little bit, but I found out from Seattle that that was okay for a very small system, but for anything a little bit larger, it wasn't suitable. Quite by accident, I guess, after investigating and researching a bit, I discovered there was something being done in Toronto by a firm that knew all about elevated systems and wanted to look someplace to introduce an elevated system. So I had my meetings in Vancouver, or in Toronto and in Vancouver, with all of the people, and we finally decided perhaps we should look into a SkyTrain. It wasn't called that at the time, but elevated rail system. So everything was researched and done, and that's what we agreed upon, in spite of the fact that some of the municipal people had already made up their mind as to what they wanted. We went ahead with that system. And they, in the end, appreciated it and obviously proceeded with it. So I served in municipal affairs for a time. After that was quite successful, the premier came back to me and said, Bill, I've now got the toughest challenge of all. Would you become the Minister of Education? I said, wow, there's a lot of problems in education. And if you want controversy, obviously, you wouldn't want to put me there. If you don't want controversy, you don't want to put me there because there will be a lot of controversy. And he said, no, something needs to happen in education. So I was made the Minister of Education, and I immediately had some problems with strikes within the educational system. I had some problems in that I was trying to introduce a little more discipline and order within the system. I didn't see it there at the time. So there was obviously opposition. But things went along well. We cut the budget, we finally had peace within the ministry, and everything was moving along reasonably okay. Then back in 1983, I decided that I wanted to retire from it all. I'd done it. I wanted to just leave it be, get back to doing business, particularly since Lillian, my wife, had taken over running the business because I wasn't there ever. I was always in Victoria or in between or someplace else in the province or country. So she had taken over the business, did a super good job, but it was a bit much for her, I thought. So I wanted to retire, which I did. That didn't last long, because in 1986, the pressure came on from including former colleagues. One in particular who practically camped out on my doorsteps was Jack Davis. Jack Davis was a well-known individual. He was involved provincially at the time. He was also a former member of parliament, a popular one, and did a good job. So he was wanting me to, he was encouraging me. But not only him, there were other members that thought perhaps I could do a job as premier of the province. So the pressure was on for me to get involved again. And so I took on the challenge when there was already 10 or 11 people in the running, and the campaign was probably half over when I accepted to take it on. But again, things went well. I worked at it, things went well, lots of good help, nice people, and I became the premier. When I was premier, one of the first things that landed on my desk again was the whole question of transportation, particularly as it applied to BC Electric, BC Hydro at the time. When I was a child, I lived in Bradner, and I went to school in Abbotsford. Mm-hmm. I went to Philip Sheffield High School. As a matter of fact, I wanted to finish beyond Philip Sheffield and go into university, even thought of becoming a lawyer. Back in those days, at school in Abbotsford, they took you once a week, oftentimes, to various businesses where you would work or help for a day. They took me to a dentist. What was his name? Moran. Probably a lot of people in Abbotsford will still know the name Dr. Moran. So I served the dentist for a day or two or three, but they decided maybe that's not where I wanted to go. Then they took and assigned me to a bank. And that had some interest, but no, I didn't want to be a banker. So we went through all of that, and I thought I wanted to be a lawyer. So I worked in a lawyer's office for a few days just to learn what happened in a lawyer's office. It was a good process. However, back in those days when I lived in Bradner, if we wanted to, and I, as a child particularly, because I came from Holland at the age of 14, and we lived on the track in Bradner, and Lombard Station, as it was called then, Lombard Station, which was next to Rand Station, next to the Bradner Station, at the other end we had the Coghlan Station, or the County Line Station. So we could take the tram back in those days. It was a BC Electric tram, and we could travel from where we lived, get on the train right on the property, that's where the station was, and get right on the tram, go to Abbotsford for 10 cents. And the conductor at a time was a very popular alderman later in Vancouver. His name was Don Bellamy. Don Bellamy was the conductor. And it was just a treat to go on the tram in those days. The conductor was a very nice guy, told us stories while we traveled quickly to Abbotsford for the 10 cents. When we got to Abbotsford, we could go to the Abbotsford Odeon Theater for 25 cents. And at the end of the Odeon performance, we could travel to the Teddy Bear restaurant in Abbotsford for and buy a milkshake for 25 cents. Wonderful times. Good days. It's all changed a lot. It's going to change a lot more. But anyway, we appreciated the BC Electric tram in front of the property. It came quite regularly. It was inexpensive. But in 1953, they decided it was not making any money. Back in those days, they had to make money. And they decided they needed to discontinue. There was no controversy. It was just back in those days, again, people accepted things a little bit more than what they would today. The tram was discontinued, unfortunately, for some. And it was that way for quite some time. Then BC Electric started to run freight on the track. And that seemed to work for a time, but not too long, because in 1986, when I was the premier, the BC Hydro people came to us and said, we've got to discontinue the freight. We're losing too much money. We're having to subsidize it with our electricity rates, and it doesn't work. So we have to discontinue the freight. Well, I kind of read between the lines, because probably it was a bit much for them to manage, and they were probably not doing a good enough job, and they were looking to somebody like CP Rail to take over the running of the freight. But they couldn't sell it to BC Rail without it going to tender. And there were a few other businesses, particularly one of the U.S., Southern Rail, I think it was in Chicago, that had an interest in it, and they wanted to quote on it as well. So BC Electric wanted to sell the rail line, really. They wanted to select or sell the whole thing. And I called in my colleague at the time. He was the minister responsible, Jack Davis. And I said, Jack, let's go through this carefully and see what it is they're wanting and why they're wanting it and what's behind it, what's not behind it, what's the benefit to them, what's the benefit to us, what's best for the province. So the whole thing was studied fairly carefully. And BC, Jack Davis came back to me and said, look, we have to make some sort of an arrangement because they want to go out for bids, but we shouldn't sell the whole thing. We need to really look at this very carefully. So we had several meetings, as I recall it, and I just don't exactly know who all involved, but in the end we decided we would sell in 21, not a lease per se, but like a lease, where they would have the running rights for freight on the tracks for 21 years. And then at either option, it would be renewed after the 21 years. And we also decided we would not sell the right of way. We would never sell the right of way. We would not sell the air rights. We would also make sure there was a provision in the agreement that if any time we wanted to take the track to use it for passenger rail, that would have priority. We would take over, and CP Rail or whomever using the track would have to reinstate things in first-class condition at the time. If they needed to double-track it for whatever reason in any stretch of the tracks, it would be at their expense. So basically, we had full control, but BC Electric, BC Hydro at the time then, had what they wanted. They were out of the business, which was good. And for us, it was important, too, to make sure that the freight was getting to the ports, because freight running is good for the province, for the economy. So the deal was presented in that fashion. It was accepted by CP Rail, and by the Southern Rail, and the details of that you can get separately. But anyway, things went along reasonably well. Then when the regional district started to look at my old municipality of Surrey, where I had been the mayor and council member for a time, for extending the rail line, the SkyTrain to Langley, I watched it for a time, and it went along quietly, too quietly perhaps, for a bit, until my good friend Rick Green, former mayor of Langley, whom I'd also known as an alderman in the municipality where I now live, and in Delta, he came along and he said with his team, before that I had already read some information that had been presented to the media by Dr. Patrick Condon, who's a professor at the university, UBC, and who's an expert in planning. He had taken an interest with Rick Green in promoting the interurban rail, interurban community rail, as they call it now. And I had an interest. So when Rick called me and said, we'd like you to get involved because you're familiar with it all, and It's probably something you'd like to get involved with and promote. He was assuming and presuming, but that's okay. We had a meeting right in this room, and there was five or six members that he worked with very closely, and he convinced me that I could be the face of it. I wouldn't have to do much work, but I could be the face of it and help promote it. Well, that seemed very interesting. And that's where it went.
Yeah, so that kind of brings us to today. Excuse me. So I think we have a lot of groups and a lot of people over the last 20 years that have been interested in seeing the interurban rail line be reinvigorated and reused. And the ability to do that, I think listeners will find it quite interesting that it was your government that created the agreement that reserved the passenger rights on that line so that we have that opportunity today. And I think people will also find it interesting. I mean, I think your whole story is interesting. There'll be people out there that will be shocked to know they had to go to work instead of get welfare. I think that will be shocking. And a 10-cent ride on any public transit system is also a shocking tale. But it's an amazing story in that we had that system in place. And despite the fact that it still exists today, there seems to be so much opposition against it. But we have other things to compare it to. So, you know, as the intellectual architect of SkyTrain, is it interesting for you to see the way people compare SkyTrain and rail and buses, for example? So, you know, to lead you down the path there a little bit, I've read a lot of reports comparing the interurban rail line to bus service, but very few comparing rail to SkyTrain. What are your thoughts on that? You know, I take it that based on your position that you're a believer that that rail is the best solution of those three, and there are other options for transit. But do you feel that comparison is fair between rail and buses and rail and SkyTrain? Do you think it stands alone? What's your opinion?
Well, everything has its place. And I think there's a number of things that need to be considered in all of this. First of all, is it economical or is it totally unreasonable? If it's not economical and not reasonable, it'll fail. It'll fail if it doesn't wash financially, there will be problems with it. So that's a consideration. The second consideration I think needs to be, is it practical and can it be used in the area where it's being proposed? SkyTrain is great, works wonderfully well in Vancouver, in Burnaby, maybe even New Westminster, where you already have a density of population. But where you don't have the density of population, you can't take, as we see it proposed now, and run a SkyTrain, in my opinion, a SkyTrain through the Green Timbers to get to Fleetwood. Fleetwood is a nice little piece of Surrey, but there isn't a whole lot of development, and property is still quite expensive. And if you go through Green Timbers, you've got big problems because you're cutting down a swath of tree through an area that people treasure. So that's a consideration. Whatever the plan, whatever the transit plan proceeded with, it needs to achieve not just a good mode of transportation, that's primary, very important, but you also need to take into consideration what are the planning effects of all of this? What are you getting for it? So if we run a SkyTrain from Surrey Centre to Fleetwood, we're really getting 6 kilometers of track at best. And there's going to be a couple of stations. There won't be a whole lot of development coming from it, at least not in the short term. It'll be very, very long term. And it'll be a good while before it proceeds from there to Langley and Abbotsford. So we need to look at something beyond that. And with the proposed interurban community rail, we can do a good job of planning the valley. The valley is going to develop big time over. It's already happening, but it's going to happen much faster as time goes on. Look at the whole of the North American continent. Look at what the weather everywhere and what's happening socially, politically, otherwise, and compare where we are here to the rest of it. We are tons above everything else. So people are going to learn about that. If they're living in Quebec, if they're living in Ontario, if they're living in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, or Alberta, eventually they dream about moving to the Fraser Valley. Yes. And there's only so many people we can have in the Fraser Valley and still have it a very livable place. I don't ever want it to see like Los Angeles or San Francisco or even Seattle or Vancouver, but not so much Vancouver, it's not too bad. So in order to avoid that, we need to have a means, and the interurban community rail would be that means, to seeing pockets of more higher density development around stations in locations where it's not affecting the agricultural land or the green belts. Yeah. And I think the proposed interurban system achieves that, presents that. So there's much more to building a rail line or a transit system than just laying a rail and putting something on the tracks.
You know, it's interesting you put it that way and you relate it to density. I do recall over the years, people have said, why don't we have a rail line right down the middle of Highway 1? And the government of whatever day has always said, well, there's no density there. And I've always found that counterintuitive because the land is cheap and you get to decide then where future density goes if you put rail in. In an ironic twist, Bombardier, the company that builds the trains that roll down those tracks, had a commercial, television commercial some years ago, and it actually showed a train going through the countryside in China. And, you know, China is a country with some pretty good density, dense pockets in it. And they would build trains that would go through the countryside and connect areas of density. And they would open up areas of the countryside by putting a train to it so then people could develop around it. So the argument against a train going down the middle of Highway 1 is counterintuitive to what the rest of the world seems to do. We see a little bit of that argument with rail as well. Some of those stations, and I'm, as an Abbotsford resident, I ride my bike out on the Matsqui Flats, and there's a couple of stations, old stations you can see out there. And one of the arguments against the rail is, well, there's nothing out there. But I think that's kind of the point, is it can be cheaply recovered. The stations are cheap. There's very little need to gather up new land to build stations or to beef up the rail at all. So I also find that argument then gets flipped on its head when they talk about, as you just mentioned, the Green Timbers Fleetwood line. SkyTrain is best for density and surface rail is best for low density, or at least that's what the rest of the world seems to show us with their development. So I wonder, and it feels a little bit like politicians and perhaps even TransLink tend to play that game they have at the fair called whack-a-mole, that every time someone's got a proposal or a new idea for transit, that politicians and play whack-a-mole with it. So they bonk that idea on the head with whatever objection that they can come up with. I've asked a couple of people this question now. Do you have a sense of what is the core objection to rail? And so everybody seems to think that widening Highway 1 is a good idea. People seem to think that SkyTrain in the downtown core is a good idea. But nobody seems to, in the political arena, seems to be very heavily on board with supporting the interurban rail line. And when I say politicians, there are local politicians. We have some mayors that have backed us up. But it seems the province is taking a long time to get ahead of steam behind it. And every time there seems to be a head of steam, TransLink seems to pop its head up and play that whack-a-mole game with, oh, well, you've dealt with our last objection, so we have a new report. And that new report doesn't seem to really answer any questions. it's just an opportunity to once again suppress the movement against rail. Do you have any idea what maybe the core objection might be to obviously utilizing this asset that you reserved back in 1986 for the province?
Well, if we can look at the present proposal of running a rail line from Surrey Centre to Fleetwood, we should look at that because that's a big bill. As a matter of fact, it takes all the money that we'll see for decades to come. Mm-hmm. So therefore, that's it. We need to look at that very carefully. So looking at that, one could, as you suggested, question why it is they're proposing what they're doing. Have they looked at the alternative? What's the effect on freeways and existing roads, etc.? The big problem we suffer oftentimes in our province, and maybe more so with Canadian people, with us Canadians, than what we see it in many other places, other countries, is that we tend to accept we don't want problems. We'll take life as it comes. It's been very nice and very easy and comfortable for most people. So no one digs into things too much. And we find democracy is not what we think it to be until it bothers us personally or individually. And I think these decisions were in part made politically during an election campaign by the mayor at the time in Surrey, and still the mayor. Well, he was running at the time for mayor. And that certainly had an effect on all of this. And I think what we're seeing now in this particular case is politics are involved, but even more so, face-saving. Studies were done, money was spent, arguments were made in support of what they're now proposing to proceed with, and they don't want to appear to be the losers. It's a lot of face-saving. And the people 10 or 15 years from now aren't going to worry or think too much or care too much about people wanting face-saving. So we've got to go ahead with something good. And using the freeways, we can certainly improve upon the freeways. There's things can be done, will be done, and should be done. But to count on the freeways to be the traffic movers in the Fraser Valley, I think could be a big mistake. For anyone that travels to Southern California and sees what happened on the freeways there, they even, on Highway 10, run a train for quite some distance down the middle of the freeway. Mm-hmm. It hasn't worked out that well. You can't have pockets of development happening on a freeway like you might in a plant system with a interurban rail or the likes of it. So no, using the freeway would be a mistake, or counting on the freeway particularly to move all the traffic would be a mistake, because you would only start seeing more and more development near the freeway, which puts more pressure on the freeway. You need to divert it in a practical and sensible way.
So following on from that topic, I'd like to switch gears just a little bit and talk about your opinion on the way transit is being funded. You know, I think that has changed drastically over the years. And in recent times, we've developed not only TransLink, but the Mayor's Council theoretically worked together to come up with funding mechanisms for all aspects of transit. I think a lot of people listening, and my opinion as well, that some of the resources that they use to fund transit involve very regressive forms of taxation. So, for example, adding on to property taxes is an option. And that sort of thing isn't really means tested at all. So, you know, it actually can sting a lot of people that are too poor to move the house that they bought in 1955. So I'm interested in what your opinion is on funding transit as a whole, and if you have some suggestions. So just to lead you a little bit more there, the GVRD has their own methodology for funding, and the Fraser Valley Regional District is separate, but the interurban rail line would connect those two districts, and so there would be some funding crossover there. And I know that that every avenue of funding is on the table when you're talking about projects of this size. But what would be your feelings, your suggestion on where some of that funding might come from, or if you feel that the current way that we go about deciding on funding is valid? What are your just sort of general thoughts on that and the expensive nature of projects like this?
Unfortunately, most of our taxation is regressive. It's the people that go to work every day, the working guy or gal, that pays the bulk of the taxes. They pay it every time they buy anything in the store. They pay it when they buy a gallon or a liter of gasoline. They pay it when they pay their property tax. Yeah, most taxes, unfortunately, are very regressive. What's being proposed now is, again, more tax on the gasoline. We're already the highest paying gasoline tax payers in North America by far. They're also proposing, and we're already paying it on our utility bills. We're paying it on our property tax. They also now have a proposed tax basically it's almost like a capital gains tax. It's a development tax. So it's every time any development takes place, there's a tax. So yeah, the taxes are very regressive. What do I propose might be a better way? Well, I think perhaps that's something that I alone can't give, and no one really needs to. We need to address it using all the expertise we can get, because it could be that it's a capital gains tax. Maybe it's something as simple as that. But that involves the federal government, that involves the provincial government, that also involves or affects the local government. But perhaps a capital gains tax is the way to go. But I can't say that without having all of the information to back it up and to find out what the effect of it. But every time if we put a transit into an area, it affects property taxes considerably. And the amounts are substantial. So you'll get a lot more, a lot quicker than you might putting it on a liter of gasoline.
Yeah.
And it won't be as regressive.
I know it's a very hard question to answer. You know, it's one of those, you know, big debates. Taxes in general are always a very big debate. You know, what's appropriate, what's not. Do you tax property or do you tax an individual's income? And there are good and bad examples all around the world of that. You know, people like to hold places like Scandinavia up as a gold standard, but their marginal tax rate is astronomically high. You can't really transfer these taxes around the world that way, because we haven't grown our tax base in that way. So if you were to now move the tax burden to income tax, you would effectively have high property taxes and high income taxes. There would be no relief anywhere. So it's a very difficult question to...
The problem I see in part, for a good part at least, is that by having a variety of taxes, they can increase things more slowly and collect more money without the public really being aware of what it is they're paying. So by having a variety of taxes, if the utility bill goes up a few pennies, hardly anyone notices it. If the tax on the gasoline goes up a penny or two, well, we just pay it. We see it changing all the time anyway. For the majority of people, they won't even know it's happening, unfortunately. And that's part of the problem, I think. It's taxes being so spread out that we're not aware of what it's really costing.
And you know, when we're talking about the interurban rail corridor, the interurban community rail line, we are talking, and I think I might have mentioned this at the beginning, or I should have anyway, that we're talking about 100 kilometers of rail line connecting as far out as Chilliwack I think the full plan is all the way out to Chilliwack. And lots of different costing has been done on that. But I want to narrow our focus to talk about this rail line down to just one section, because there is one section that's in contention, and potentially because of its cost. And that is approximately a 7 kilometer, maybe a little bit more than 7 kilometers of rail line that would conflict with current freight traffic. And I don't want to talk too much about the particulars of that, but I'd like to get your opinion on whether or not that should be a deal breaker. When we're talking about 100 kilometers of rail to service passengers in and out of the valley and into the downtown core, should 7 kilometers stop us from looking at that as a viable option?
Definitely not, no. The 7 kilometers shouldn't stop it, nor is there any need for it to stop us, because already there's an agreement in place that deals with the 7 kilometers as it does with the balance of the track. So it can be dealt with. But if there's a lot of freight in a particular stretch at any one time that presents a problem for us moving passengers, then they can and should double track. There's enough room. And in some of those places, if required, they can acquire more right away. So I think it can be dealt with.
You know, I think people listening, particularly if they listened to the beginning of this conversation, I think they will get the sense that every time you've had a mandate, you've gotten something done with your mandate. A minister of transport, social services, even as premier of the province, you've gotten some action done. I would imagine, and I'm going to put words in your mouth and then you can tell me if I'm right or wrong. I would imagine that presented with the proposal this interurban community rail line, that you would already be sitting down at the table with CP Rail, with all the stakeholders, with BC Hydro. I think there's a lot of negotiating to be done on this deal as part of a holistic transit plan. Would that have been your first tactic, much like you did with welfare? You'd be sitting.
Absolutely. And I'm wondering perhaps now where the planners that started out initially, both at the regional level, provincial level, or those that are involved directly with TransLink, why they haven't looked at all of these options a lot closer than what they have. I keep coming back to thinking that perhaps they already have made commitments. Perhaps they've made promises. Possibly it's a matter of face saving. I was part of that. I did that. We did a good job and we spent all this money. We don't want to change it. It's all of those things. But whatever is decided upon, and now is the time to decide, will affect the whole of the Fraser Valley, the whole of the Lower Mainland dramatically. For decades, decades, decades to come. So if it isn't looked at carefully, and what the impact and the effects of all of this in detail now, there won't be a second chance. So in a place like one of my favorite places, Abbotsford, where perhaps there's questions about all of this, if we don't do it properly now, if we don't consider this, we're going to regret it. I won't, but others will in 25, 30, or 40 years, or maybe sooner.
I totally agree. And I would imagine that it would be your opinion that a way to get this on the table and get politicians to pay attention is for public opinion to get stirred up, for people that are listening to send a letter to their local MLA, to send a letter to their local city council. And show their support. Would that be a way that you think people can get involved?
Absolutely. Public opinion. That's what happened with the HST. Everyone said, you can't do it. It's impossible. What the legislation demands of you to be done in order to stop the HST just can't be done. 10% of all of the people in every constituency, whether they've ever voted or not, they're counted. 10%. 85 constituencies. And we did it. it can be done because public opinion was with us. People came to meetings. People were out there handing out pamphlets, information, putting up signs. It was terrific. It was a wonderful experience. And if there's enough public opinion gets behind the interurban community rail, we'll win it. No question about it.
That is a great spot to end our conversation. I appreciate your time. Stay tuned. We're going to let you know of a number of websites that you can follow along with this story and lend your support. And also, we're going to give you some resources on how you can get in touch with your local and provincial politicians. But for today, I have to say thank you, Bill VanderZam, for not only talking with us, but for lending your voice to this issue, putting it out there, getting it in front of the public eye, and for using that great energy to support yet again another great issue for the people of British Columbia.
My pleasure. I'm going to keep on fighting with these hard people, hard working people that are involved now, Rick, Green, and the lot. They're working so hard at it. I'll help them all I can, and I want to be with them if possible at the opening of the first train.
Sounds great to me. Thanks very much, and enjoy the rest of your summer.
Do you want more information, or would you like to get involved with the Interurban Community Rail Line? Then visit southfrasercommunityrail.ca. Lots of great information there, lots of links, but also contact your local politicians. Tell them you want this. That's how we'll get it done, just like the HST. Thanks, Bill. Have a great day, everyone.